court is ready for your argument from petitioners in Utica versus American
Indemnity Court.
The court should reverse and render judgment
that Utica had no duty to defend,
no duty to indemnify for a single threshold.
That is because every single claim that was alleged against the insurer in the underlying action required the occurrence of excluded conduct in order to be actioned.
That excluded conduct being the rendering of professional services,
in this case through the administration of anesthesia attorney.
Where was the administration of anesthesia professionally negligent? Where was professional judgment brought in?
We don't know if it was or not.
To be honest.
Isn't that critical, though, to the exclusion?
Absolutely not.
I think the thing to do here is turn the tab on one of my little handouts here. What I've done under tab one is to quote the language of the exclusion. The exclusion is not applied to bodily injury due to rendering or failure to render the professional service. One thing that you will notice is that the word negligence does not appear there. The other thing that you will notice is that it does not require that the professional services be rendered by the insured in this claim and coverage.
So this is negligence, and let's back up and consider how this is done.
We apply the eight corners rule in terms of determining the existence of coverage.
That means that we look at the allegations of the petition and we look at the language of the policy. In every case, this court has decided, the most recent one being King, focuses on the language of the policy.
You don't inquire at the defense stage, was the rendition of the services negligent or not?
If it turns out in this case the allegation was that it was negligent.
That happened to be the allegation.
But critical to the inquiry here is the fact that it was rendition of professional services, whether negligent or not. That is the operative language.
Let me get the facts straight, because after reading the briefs, I'm not entirely clear. The insured here was an anesthesia group.
Correct.
And they had, I assume, some type of contract with this outpatient surgery center.
Apparently so.
Which was, however, a different entity. It may have had some of these doctors that owned it, maybe some other. Surely you don't have a surgery center with no surgeons.
Right.
And the person who is primarily at fault in this situation was an employee of, was hired by and was an employee of this surgery center.
Right, although the pleadings on that are a little confusing, but yes.
Yeah, well, I was getting confused. Now, right. 44 people were hurt and have sued and have settled and are no longer around here.
That's correct.
And they sued, and I assume got some money from the anesthesia group under its professional policy and also under the American Indemnity General Liability policy.
And that's because the difference between those 44 and these four is that those 44 came a little bit later.
Well, I think my understanding is that 40 or 44, however many, there was a number who settled out earlier on in the occurrence, and it's only when we got up to about the 18th petition.
All of these occurrences were back in 92, is my understanding. So it was only up to the 18th position that Utica was called upon to defend. So at that point, there was only a couple of layers left. Because of where its layering was, or because nobody noticed that they were out there?
Well, the logical surmise is that by the 18th, plaintiff's counsel were able to say, let's snag in some additional insurance, and let's come up with 26 allegations.
Is there anything in this record about whether the surgical center was ever sued and whether its insurance was ever implicated? It's not in here anymore. Right.
I don't know whether the search result centers on the hook or not from the record. People that were involved in the underlying suit, people that were involved in the underlying suit, could tell you who was.
Now, it's also clear the anesthesiology group was trying to get insurance for anything that might happen to it.
Correct.
And so they bought a general liability policy, which is a cheaper policy because that's weird things happening to you. And then this professional policy, which is an expensive policy because you're going to get sued all the time on that, I guess.
Right. And they ultimately recovered under the professional liability policy. If they went to trial
and the jury failed to find professional negligence, that is, that you should have noticed that this vial had been tampered with and not given it, would they be covered under that policy? They might get a defense, but would they be covered?
Probably not.
So what we're forcing these doctors, these anesthesiologists into, is either crawling up on the stand and saying, boy, I was really negligent. I mean, a 40-powered magnifying glass, and I could have told that vial had been tampered with, and I should always do that. Or we're forcing them to crawl up and say, no, I'm not a bad doctor. People should still come to me. And in that event, they aren't going to have any coverage from their general liability policy because you all are long gone, and they're not going to be covered by their professional policy.
I think that the tough thing about this case is
you can hypothecate, and that's what you've done. Well, this didn't take me very long. Aren't we supposed to interpret these things reasonable expectation of the insured and the fact that you all know these policies are working with other policies and to try to provide them with coverage?
Well, I mean, everything was right up until the last thing you said. What we are trying to do in these cases, and the overarching policy concern here should be to give effect to the language of the policy as written, the legitimate expectations of the party that has framed within the policy.
Is there a policy they could have bought? Would Utica sell a policy to a medical association that was trying to be covered for this situation?
It may be that out there would exist some umbrella policy that would ultimately cover them in this type of
situation. That's not what you're going on.
That's not what I'm going on, because we don't have that in the record.
That's not what I'm
going on. But I think that the thing that you have to recognize, and this is kind of the hard reality, because if you want to talk, and let me just spend a little time on the policy concerns. You can, as you have done, and it did not take you long, hypothecate a situation in which there's no coverage. On the other hand, this is what's critical. If you go with the way that they have framed the test, you can hypothecate situations where coverage for the general liability carrier can be manufactured in every case like this. There is no end to the inventiveness of plaintiff's counsel. In this case, there's 27 allegations. In every case, you can come up with some antecedent act or some post act that says, well, you know, that's not per se excluded, hence there's coverage. So that's the reality. On this side, the bad is you can hypothecate no coverage. On this side, you can hypothecate the situation of manufactured coverage. What you have to do down the middle is apply the
language. What you have to do down the middle is apply the language. Let's say that this anesthesiology group had taken these vials and given them to another anesthesiology group. Somebody needed some additional vials, and they said, give us some, and they shipped them over to them, and these doctors in this group never used them.
Okay.
The allegation is that they didn't supervise the maintenance of the vials, that's an administrative negligent type act.
Okay.
Because these doctors would not be performing any sort of professional service that caused the injury. There would be coverage in that situation, wouldn't there?
Probably not, if I'm following the hypothetical correctly. In other words, what you're saying is that this is another group now that has administered.
Yes.
Okay. And what you would have to still look for is what was the cause of the injury? How were the people injured? Were they injured by the rendition of professional service? If they answer that question, yes.
But they're claiming that the anesthesiology group in my office injured them by not carefully monitoring the maintenance of the vials.
I understand. Stand for this proposition. It's another Fifth Circuit case. It's not in the briefs, I don't believe.
Go further.
It's Western Heritage.
And there's a number of cases that stand for this proposition.
998F3rd311 at 313. There the court says, when the petition does not contain sufficient facts to enable the court to determine if coverage exists, it is proper to look at extrinsic evidence to adequately address the issue. In other words, you may have situations where people are trying to craft their pleadings in such a way as to not trigger coverage. But the bottom line is, in this case, the only way that any of these 44 people could have sustained any injury whatsoever was through the rendering of professional services, i.e. the administration of anesthesia during surgery. That was the mechanics of all of it. And let me go on in that.
Don't go on in the
administration of anesthesia during surgery. That was the mechanics of all of them.
I read that
later.
And let me go on a minute.
I'm sorry.
I think
the court is ready to hear argument from respondents.
May it please the court. Tom Cottle and Daniel Jordan present argument for respondents. Mr. Cottle will open the first 10 minutes.
May it please the court. Mr. Tom Cottle and Daniel Jordan present argument for respondents. Mr. Cottle will open the first 10 minutes.
May it please the court. This matter involves both the duty to defend and the duty to indemnify. Now, in the Court of Appeals,
this matter,
the coverage issues that you briefed were the same under both duties. The Court of Appeals addressed those coverage issues. It didn't mention the duty to indemnify other than a couple of times. What I want to briefly do is address the coverage issues and do it in the context, real briefly, of the duty to indemnify and show that the Court of Appeals' judgment in that regard was correct,
and do it in the
although perhaps a little lacking in language. Now, I don't know how many times I heard Mr. Alexander say, look at the language of the exclusion. Look at the language of the exclusion.
Now, I don't know how many times I heard Mr. Alexander say,
this injury does not apply to bodily injury due to rendering or failure to render any professional
service. This injury does not apply to
what
bodily injury
is given to the language due to
render.
If it just means in the context of, you can sell this anesthetic to another group, to somebody else, and they administer it.
It just means,
all right?
In the context,
is that due to the rendition of professional services?
To another
all
group.
That is the conduct.
Somebody else.
Or the context.
And they administer it. All right? Is that due to
the rendition of professional services?
All that is
deals
conduct.
But explain to me what duty the anesthesiology group has that it can be insured for where the injury results from the administration of medicine. Explain to me what duty the anesthesiology group in this office has to ABC out there for maintaining this medicine unadulterated.
I believe they have statutory duties under federal laws, I believe some state laws regarding the control of storage of controlled substances.
And so a public member can, if they don't do that, a public member has a claim against them because of the worry and concern that this isn't properly saved.
So when you say a public member, you're talking about somebody in the
citizen off the street.
Okay.
You argue they've got a duty to ABC out there because there's a federal law that talks about how you maintain drugs.
Okay.
Right.
And I'm saying so a citizen who thinks that they're not maintaining the drugs safely has a suit against them for mental anguish or whatever.
Now, obviously, the claimant off the street has to have been injured in some way.
But the only way this person can be injured is if they seek professional medical care. And they receive professional medical care.
They have to seek professional medical care from somebody.
But if they do that, then doesn't this policy exclude coverage if the injury is the result of receiving professional medical care?
Only, Your Honor, only if you want to rewrite the policy and strike out the words due to and insert in the context of.
No, due to. I mean, this is a direct inserting the needle, pushing the medicine in there, which is, I don't know how a jury could find that that's not medical care, but how is that not a direct related to, as direct as you can possibly get, that was a result of medical care that they got injured?
Your Honor, it goes back to the basic rules of construction for insurance policies here in Texas. All right. And ambiguities in policies are construed in favor of coverage with a special vengeance in the context of an exclusion. All right. Reasonable interpretation of the exclusion that would afford
coverage
should be adopted, even if the insurer offers a more reasonable construction.
Your
belief is that due to or could be substituted within the context of, and that's a reasonable construction, fine, that doesn't change the fact that due to should be a reasonable construction of that clause, is that it means proximate cause.
Isn't it part of rendering professional services maintaining
that doesn't change the fact that due to should be a reasonable construction of that clause, is that it means proximate cause.
Or they knew they could get adulterated. Isn't that part of rendering professional services? When I go to my doctor and get a shot, I expect him or her to have kept the medicine properly.
Your Honor, first I'd say that the fact that the, what they're calling the antecedent acts of negligence, whether or not they were professional services or not, is not been brought forward by you.
First I'd say,
beyond that,
the fact that
no, if you look at the case law that construes the term professional services,
is not been brought forward.
That refers to an exercise
beyond
of skill, judgment, specialized knowledge peculiar to them, to their profession. And
so if my doctor puts the serum out on the in the windowsill and it's really hot and it spoils it, then he injects me with that. That's not rendering professional services.
No, Your Honor, I don't believe so, because there are all sorts of businesses that are required to carry perishable substances to sell. Those are general things. Whenever you're a product's liability issue, you need to maintain the purity and unadulterated condition of the product that you sell. That is not a duty that is peculiar to anesthesiologists.
But I suppose if the physician took too much drug out or too little drug out, that would clearly be professional service. Administered the wrong dose.
Yes, that's nothing to diagnose.
And if he contaminated the needle himself in the process of administering the dose, you would say that was professional services.
I'm not sure exactly how
he wiped it on his pants. He dropped it on the floor. He sneezed on it. He sat there and looked at it, and he knew he'd done something wrong, but he said, oh, well, maybe it won't hurt, and he stuck it in anyway. That would be professional services.
Probably.
If he knew his nurse had done that.
I wouldn't think that the nurse would change the scenario, no.
They knew that when the drug had come into the building, the nurse who took it, the receptionist who took it, the physician who took it, whoever it was, if that person had known that in the process of taking it, it had been mishandled in such a way that it might be contaminated, would that be professional service?
I think you're getting pretty far afield there, Your Honor.
When you say due to is proximate cause, you're really incorporating the same union pump problems that we struggled with.
I think you're
trying
getting pretty
to
far
see
afield
how
there,
attenuated
Your
the conduct is from the injury. Is that?
I'm not familiar with the union pump case. What I'm trying to do is offer a reasonable construction of this exclusion that would afford coverage. A reasonable construction of the exclusion is that but for
what
requires that the rendition of the professional services be a proximate cause of the injury. And that in reference to professional services, in that this is an exclusion from the business liability coverage afforded by this policy, is that it refers to the professional services of the insured seeking coverage.
Well, that's where I have a problem. When you look at that definition, it's irrelevant when you read it who the actor is. I mean, it doesn't say rendition, bodily injury due to the insured rendering or failing to render professional services. It doesn't define actor, and it makes the actor irrelevant. And so the focus has to be on whether or not professional services were rendered.
Let me address it first. Utica first raised the argument of whether or not the provider of the professional services needed to be the insured, or if it could be somebody else, in their reply brief in this court.
Utica first raised
the first
argument
time we've heard that. All right.
provider of professional
beyond the, this issue of waiver, though, the language of the policy really doesn't support that kind of construction. Think about it. If you look at the policy, you've got a section that's entitled covered. All right. Under that, you've got a part that's entitled waiver, business liability.
The language of the policy really doesn't support that.
It says we will pay those sums that the insurer becomes legally obligated to pay as damages because of bodily injury to which this insurance applies. Then you drop down a page or two and you've got an exclusion section.
It says, quote,
applicable to business liability coverage. This insurance does not apply to, drop down a couple pages, business, bodily injury due to rendering or failure to render professional services. By talking about exclusions to the business liability coverage, you're automatically talking about insurance for which for damages for which the insurer can be obligated. And an insured doctor who did not render medical services could not be liable for someone else's negligent rendition of medical services. Whether it be the hospital, some other anesthesia group that they sell the products to, or what? In any event,
what would be the proof? Talking about medical your scenario, how this policy has coverage here, what would be the proof that you say you'd have to bring to the court that would entitle you to a judgment that would cover this insurance policy, that would have damages covered by this insurance policy? What would you have to prove?
I think we've proved that in this matter. We proved the insuring agreement. Legally obligated to pay.
Well, no. I guess I'm talking about, you say the legally obligated to pay. What would be your proof of liability on the part of the anesthesiology clinic for having contaminated medicine? I mean, that would thus entitle the injured party to be compensated in damages.
In this matter, that proof is because Utica breached its duty to defend. That's a legal consequence of their failing or breaching their duty to defend. That's standard insurance law.
I guess I'm not being clear. They're arguing that the underlying liability can only be predicated upon providing medical professional service. That's excluded under the policy, and therefore there's no coverage. You're saying this is not medical, this is not professional service, therefore there is coverage. And I'm going to this medical service. You're saying it's not medical service. And so I'm asking you, what is it that you would then prove to establish liability under the policy? Not liability under the policy. Liability of the insured. What would you prove to establish liability of the insured?
How Judge McGrath in the Mitchell lawsuit, how that would have played out, I don't know. I understand he was inclined to grant a negligence per se summary judgment so that only damages was submitted against the anesthesia group. Point is, though, that Utica, in its reply brief, admits they're not challenging legal law that the insurer were legally obligated to pay. That's issue should just take it out of the case. And not only by their admission, but also by the fact that they breached their duty to defend. As a consequence of breaching a duty to defend, an insurer doesn't get to go out and say, tell his insurer that you weren't legally obligated to settle. That's a legal consequence of
breaching a duty to defend.
It is negligent per se for a doctor to administer contaminated medicine to the patient.
That wasn't the negligence per se claim. Mr. Jordan, actually, I need
or
to
Or was it in the securing of the locker?
It was in the security of the controlled substances.
It was violating the federal regulations.
I believe so, but again, Mr. Jordan was a little more familiar with the underlying lawsuit.
Any other questions?
This insurance applies only to bodily injury through the rendering or failure to render any professional service. Would you be covered?
If I'm ICA or the Guarantee Association, I'm going to defend the doctor who is alleged to have exposed the claimant, the patient, to I'm certainly going to reserve my rights on the doctor's
decision. My question is it covered or not?
At least not for the non-treating doctors want professional services to take that.
Thank you, Kelly.
I'm certainly going to reserve my rights on the doctor's decision. But it is I don't think so. Not at least not for the non-treating doctors want professional services to take that.
I wanted to start out by mentioning something about the role, the unique role of my client, the Hearing Association. I noted with some chagrin when I came to court before handout
I wanted to
say that my client is referred to as a professional practice insurer. My client is not an insurer at all. It's an organization created by statute to carry out certain obligations and the statute defines as a claim, and those claims arise under insurance policies issued by an insolvent property management insurer.
Who was the professional?
I see that, Your Honor. They went and became insolvent in
1997. Right, but I mean, they have professional coverage.
And those they did, in fact, and we assume their covered claim obligations under the policies that they issued to their policyholders, including this anesthesia group, that explains my client's presence and involvement in the medical litigation. There were allegations of professional malpractice that the rather than the policyholders of the allegations, the plaintiff's flagship, material liability. In fact, they sued all 10 anesthesiologists, including mine, that didn't render any anesthesia to any complaint. Was this negligence per se, the claim failing to properly store, secure, and prevent diversion of anesthesia?
But I understand their argument. They're focusing on the injury-causing event and not on the negligent act per se. So the way I understand their reasoning is, let's say you had a lab or a company that maintained this sort of anesthesiology and did that negligently. As long as the cause of the injury involved medical services, the rendition of medical services, that triggers the exclusion.
That is their position, Ron, you correctly stated it. And I think that's an interesting, it raises an interesting thing that I thought of in preparing the oral argument. The way in which most companies purchase products liability coverage is through a general liability policy. So if I'm Pfizer, some big pharmaceutical company, that's how I get
the way in which most companies purchase products.
Under this formulation of the policy, though, every prescription drug I make from Pfizer is going to be prescribed by a doctor unless it somehow gets diverted outside the chain like the David Thomas
policy.
But that means that every time that
every
my prescription drug
I make, if I'm
has some sort of problem with
it's
it,
gonna be prescribed
it's
going to
have involvement in whatever injury somebody gets from taking my drug. Will it then cause the rendition
that
of professional services?
100%
of the time.
It's going to
either or situation.
From taking my drug,
covered by one policy and not the other,
clause,
or the other policy and not this one, but it can't be covered by both, or it could be covered by both.
I think in this case there were claims that were covered under the ICA policy and claims that were covered under the general liability policy.
Is that because of the nature of the claims, or is that because of creating the plea?
I think in this case, Your Honor, and I think this is fairly far set of fact, and I don't think that the
claims that were covered.
Sort of the fact that the allegations legitimately involve those sort of administrative negligence.
I think in this
case,
and I think it's a fairly diverse
the storage of the drugs, it doesn't take professional training, skill, knowledge to understand that a lock is a much better security mechanism if the key is hanging around outside the lock, which is the case. That doesn't require
it doesn't take professional training and skill and knowledge to understand that a lot and much better.
That is legitimately
an
administrative sort of negligence like the claim in the North River case where
the rendition of medical services.
I have a window that I think is secure, but I really haven't secured it well enough to keep the suicidal patient from unscrewing the window and jumping out of the window.
The claim in the North River
now, doctor. doesn't know any more than anyone else about how to secure
a window. I have a window that I think is secure.
But the fact that the window could be opened by the patient was the cause of their death. Now, in that same case, they had a professional malpractice claim where they said, you didn't observe the patient.
Else about how to secure
you knew this person was suicidal, and but nobody was watching.
The window
if you'd been watching, you could have stopped them from unscrewing the window and jumping out of it.
Now, in that same case,
and I think that this case, the Mitchell case, is very much in the same way, in that you have both non-professional negligence. It's not a manufactured, trumped up.
If you've been watching, you could have stopped
from completing something
and jumping out of it.
If David Thomas doesn't get into the drugs and contaminate them, there is no harm to these plaintiffs.
Well, that's true, but if the plaintiff doesn't seek medical care, there's no harm to them either.
If there's no rendition,
David Thomas doesn't get into the drugs.
However, there was no necessity to prove the negligent rendition of medical services in order to prove the negligence per se claim. The plaintiffs could have dismissed their claim against their malpractice for 4599 claim against the treating physician and still proven liability on the negligence per se claim. And the very clear proof of that is that you had 10 defendants, none of whom didn't do anything to render any professional service to the one claim. So Dr. Ginty was the treating physician, Dr. Pettibone was not.
Proof of that is that
well, what about the claim against Dr. Pettibone? Dr. Pettibone didn't treat that patient.
Didn't
you have to look at coverage
to render
for each claim.
Any professional service.
Dr. Pettibone couldn't possibly have been involved in rendering medical services to somebody
Dr. Pettibone was not.
This court is
well, what about the claim against Dr. Pettibone?
What kind of conduct does it take for a doctor to even
have
a professional business
cost? Let me, but I have, on this, I'm still troubled by this whole analysis. I could understand where they fail to keep drugs that they know to be dangerous under lock and key and the drugs get stolen and or somebody gets harmed by going in and having access to it. It would be your typical premises liability. You've got to be careful that you don't have stuff on your premises that people coming on and off are going to get injured by. But wouldn't if the doctor goes and takes medicine out of the cabinet, sticks a needle in it, and it's contaminated and gives it to a patient, how can the doctor... I guess I'm asking a question. If I come forward with evidence that it's beneath the practice for the doctor to assure that the medicine hasn't been contaminated, that's a professional call. Irrespective of how it's kept by the clinic, it's still a professional call on the doctor to make sure that the medicine they're giving is not contaminated and follow whatever protocol they have. And so how would Baylor Hospital or Seton Hospital, one of the hospitals here, have a general liability policy that wouldn't be responsible for every malpractice claim made against the physicians that work there because almost always it involves some piece of property that the hospital had that gets improperly used? I don't know, it necessarily have to be contaminated medicine. It might be the wrong piece of property. Maybe it wasn't properly labeled and all sorts of things. That the reason the doctor injects the medicine as opposed to the patient doing them themselves is because the doctor is supposed to make the medical judgment that this is the safe thing to do. Huh?
Well, there's a couple of different things I can point out in answer to your question. First off, as to the treating physician, it might be a valid argument that the treating physician, that those professional duties sort of relate back, although this court has said that before somebody has a physician-patient relationship, they have to take some oath or act to treat the patient. So
it might be a valid argument
taking that duty back. But as to the treating physician, that may be a valid argument.
Professional
but as to the non-physician,
the gender,
any medical treatment, how can
I
say they had any medical professional duty to somebody that wasn't a patient? So as to coverage, you might
but
sweep
but then
the
how
treating physician
argument
under the
but this is an injury that occurs as a direct decision by a doctor to take contaminated medicine and inject it in the patient. So how is this other doctor liable? What duty has this other doctor was the doctor supposed to have undertaken to assure that this doctor who's going to provide the service will check for the contaminating medicine. I mean, it's not anticipated that a person walking in and off the premises would be injured by this medicine that may or may not be contaminated in that cabinet, whether it's locked or not. It's anticipated that if a doctor goes and injects it into the patient, the doctor needs to be covered by insurance in the event that they make that makes a mistake there.
But, Your Honor, there were claims against 9 doctors who didn't make any decision to render any kind of anesthesia or administering anesthesia to that patient. And for coverage purposes, each claim's got to be looked at claim by claim.
The claim against Dr. Pettibone.
And if one of them is the treating physician, perhaps that's covered under medical malpractice policy. But if it's a non-treating physician, I don't see any way that it could be covered under medical malpractice policy. It creates this gap in coverage that the court was asking about.
And maybe a different claim than the claim against Dr. Pettibone. One of them is the treating physician, perhaps that's covered under the medical malpractice policy. But if it's a non-treating physician, I'm not sure in way
that it's covered under medical malpractice. The first one is Justice Enoch's question about could a member of the public come in and sue because of some unarticulated concern about improper storage? The answer is no, that's the key. There would be no standing if that person came in. The only way you could come into court and be prosecuted a cause of action is if you had received the anesthesia during surgery. If you look under tab 1, I think this is critical. This is a statement of the test, the majority approach by the Ohio Court of Appeals. I think it's about as best of articulation that I've been inclined of. It says that the cover cause of loss will be covered where, number one, the claim provides a basis for a cause of action in and of itself, and two, this is critical, does not require the occurrence of the excluded person to make an action. Let's apply that here. Could negligent storage state a cause of action? Point one, answer yes.
Will be covered,
but number two, does it require the occurrence of the excluded risk, that is, the rendition of professional services to make an action? Absolutely yes. That is the key. In this case, there would not be a single person who would be in court but for the administration of anesthesia during surgery, which everyone agrees is the rendition of a professional service. What is excluded here is conduct. Point two, Justice Jefferson asked the question of, does it have to be insured, the insured that administered? Answer no, Canateo. The Fifth Circuit in Canateo analyzes that. It's also like the Burlington case out of San Antonio, Justice Duncan saying, that there is no coverage for negligent entrustment, even though in that case the excluded conduct was committed by an utterly unknown person of sexual assault on the premises. Once again, what's excluded is conduct. Number three, Justice Heck asked the question, can you hypothecate a situation where you have concurrent causation, or is it already always mutually exclusive? The granddaddy of the concurrent causation cases was actually cited by Justice Heck in the Lindsay opinion. It's in footnote 26, the case of Partridge out of California. In that case, there was a situation where people were riding along in a car, honey jackrabbits, and they had, this fellow had a gun with a hair trigger on it. He filed it down, and he decided to shoot off the road and jostle along, shot the woman next to him. She was paralyzed. In that case, the court says, well, we got two concurrent causes here. One was the use of the vehicle, and cited for that purpose that caused it, it jostled it. But this was not a situation where that was required for there to be an action with respect to the gun. Why? Because that it was